Tonight, we're going to continue our study of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We're going to look at a really interesting concept that Jesus introduces in this sermon. Several times in the past, we have discussed that expressions we use in everyday life often come from the Bible, and people have no idea that that's the origin. Not long ago, we looked at the origin of the expression, the salt of the earth. Remember that? It was just a few weeks ago. We saw that it came from this very sermon and was very biblical concept, even though most people have no idea where the expression came from. Another one we looked at closely was people having feet of clay. Do y'all remember that one? That was a while back. It came from Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a statue. It was immensely strong at the top, and as it went down, each level of the statue was increasingly weaker until the feet were made of clay, and that proved to be the statue's undoing. Nobody in Nebuchadnezzar's time could interpret that dream. But Daniel, with God's help, of course, correctly interpreted the dream, and it indicated how strong Nebuchadnezzar's reign was, but how it would increasingly be weakened over the years as each of his descendants came to power, until eventually the kingdom fell under one of his descendants. Tonight we're going to look at something that is similar but is slightly different. The expression we're going to look at is never actually stated in the Bible, but the concept behind the expression is. And the expression we're going to look at is hedging your bets. Now, who knows what hedging your bets means? It's when, let's say we're going to do something that's somewhat risky, and we take some action then to limit the magnitude of the loss if we prove to be wrong. It's the kind of thing we do to give us an out in case of the failure of the risky action. You could call it a fallback position. Suppose you have money in the stock market in very growth-oriented mutual funds. Well, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have some of your money in what is called bonds, because when the market goes down, bonds usually go up, limiting your loss. Suppose you wanted to start a new business, then that can really be risky indeed, because most small businesses, people may not know this, but most of them fail. As a hedge position, you might want to make sure you still could have a job if the business didn't succeed. Now, I owned a business at one time, and I knew that if that business didn't work out, I could go back to being a computer programmer and I would still find plenty of work. So I had a hedge position. So the term hedging has entered into all sorts of different uses. In the stock market, there are even funds called hedge funds. Did you know that? These are designed to go up when the market goes down. So you put some of your retirement funds in a hedge fund, And when the market goes down, your hedge fund goes up, and it limits the loss. Now, the question I would have that's pretty obvious if you think about it, why on earth would they use the term hedge? I mean, come on, a hedge is a row of bushes, right? And it keeps people away from a certain area. You could plant a row of hedges around a garden to keep people and animals from trampling it, or around your yard to give you some privacy. But what does that have to do with a fallback position in case of disaster? Now, to answer that question, we're going to have to go back to the origin of the concept. And I will tell you that hedge meant one thing in Jesus' day, and the word changed, or the expression changed, somewhere in the 1600s to mean how we know it today, a fallback position. But I want you to know what Jesus defined as hedging. Now, suppose there's a particular kind of temptation that you find you're vulnerable to. It isn't so wise to put yourself in a position to be tempted. You want to keep away from whatever your temptation is. Let me give you a couple of examples. Let's say you have a weakness for alcohol. Actually, that's not too hard for some of us, me including. Let's further suppose that I had this favorite ice house. Again, that's not hard for me to remember, to relate to. Back in my drinking days, I had this ice house right next to where I worked, and I would stop by there every day after work. They had this little drive-through window, and I'd get me two tall boys, and that would get me almost to the house before I ran out. Now, suppose I have gotten sober and I want to avoid drinking. Now, it would not be a smart thing for me to do to go out of my way to go by that old ice house so that I could be tempted. Now, some of you might be thinking, now wait a minute, the big book tells us that we'll reach the point where we can go anywhere without worrying about it, right? Well, that is true. But the big book also puts a condition on that. It says, if we are in a fit spiritual condition, we can go anywhere so long as there is a valid reason for us going there. For instance, after a person reaches a certain point in their sobriety and their spiritual condition is fit enough, they can probably go to all sorts of places if they have a reason to be there, such as to go and talk to an alcoholic who's still suffering, or anything else. Now, another example, some guys might be vulnerable to lust. It'd be a good idea for them not to go to visit topless bars, because that would only aggravate the temptation that they're, you know. So, you see, what we need to do in each of these cases is put up a hedge around what is tempting us that will keep us from bouncing against that temptation. Okay, Now we know what Jesus was talking about by hedging, and that brings us to today's lesson. We're going to take a look at Matthew 5, verse 22. Jesus is speaking, of course, this is the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, "You have heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But I say, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, you are in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, you are in danger of the fires of hell." Now, these are pretty serious words. I mean, that's a pretty harsh statement. But it is a classic example of hedging. Let me explain. If you put a hedge around temptation and keep yourself from bouncing up against the temptation, it's like this. The sin that we want to avoid is murder. That has to be avoided at all cost. Now, Jesus tells you we need to put a hedge around that. And if you look at his statement carefully, you see he actually puts up three different hedges around the sin of murder. The first hedge is anger. Look what he says. If you're even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. See, if we never allow ourselves to become angry, then we could never be in danger of committing the terrible sin of murder. But as we all know, things happen that can make us angry, right? I don't think any of us is perfect and never gets angry, including myself. So, what if we get angry? Then what? Well, Jesus puts up another hedge in front, in the back of the first hedge. He says, even if we get angry with someone, we shouldn't let our anger escalate to the point of speaking out against them or calling them names. If we don't allow our anger to escalate like this, then it's impossible for us to be angry enough to murder. But what if we do get angry enough to start calling their names? Well, Jesus puts up a third hedge inside that one. Even if we get angry enough to start calling them names, we need to stop short of cursing them. Now, it's important to note that he doesn't mean just using curse words. He's not talking about that. Or swearing at someone. But he means actually cursing them or threatening them or wishing them harm. When we allow our anger to reach this point and lose control of ourselves in this way, we are likely not to be in our right minds. And then it's possible, theoretically, for us to be in danger of doing violence, and even murder is not out of the question. Now, you may think, well, Pastor, that's crazy. Let me tell you something. I have visited many a prison. And I have spoken with many a man that was incarcerated for murder, and it would absolutely amaze you how many of them were convicted of murdering a good friend in the heat of an argument. Usually with drugs or alcohol involved, but that's beside the point. Now, do you see the principle involved here? I don't want you to think I could murder somebody, so I need to worry about it. It's the principle that I'm trying to teach, not the actual specifics of murder. Jesus is teaching us that whatever tempts us, we need to build a hedge around that to keep us from getting close to it. So, whatever tempts you, you should stay as far away from it as possible. Now, before I go any further, I want to ask you something about anger. Is anger a sin? Many people would think it is, but I can show you from the Bible that it is clearly not a sin. Anger is a simple human reaction. It's what you do with that anger that can become a sin. The simplest and obvious proof that anger is not a sin is that Jesus became angry on several different occasions, and the Bible also tells us that even though he was tempted in every way we are, he never once gave in to sin. Jesus was angry. Jesus never sinned. Therefore, anger is not a sin, right? Now, I mean, does anyone remember the story of him driving the money changers out of the temple with a whip? Duh. I don't think he was real happy with them. And there was another time he was about to heal a man in the synagogue on a Sabbath, and they really didn't want him to because it was the Sabbath and he would be doing work on the Sabbath. We've talked about that before. Jesus got angry at them. And the Bible actually says he looked around angry at them. So the question is, what makes Jesus' anger not a sin, where mine quite often would be considered sin? Well, there's two things that apply to Jesus. Number one, he never got angry at an offense against himself. It was always somebody had offended God, or like in the case of the man in the temple, they didn't want him to heal. They had offended the man. They had done evil to him by not wanting him to be healed. So, the other thing that's important about Jesus' anger is what he did when he got angry. Never once did he let it fester or become a resentment. He never let it grow beyond just the moment of anger. He dealt with it as best he could, and then he let it go. I want to show you another thing from the Bible, and this is a biblical proof that anger in and of itself is not a sin. Look at Ephesians 4, verse 26. And don't sin by letting anger control you. Don't let the sun go down while you are still angry. For anger gives a foothold to the devil. Now I want you to look real carefully at that statement. It does not say, don't get angry. It accepts the fact that things are going to happen that are going to cause us to get angry. What it says is, don't let that anger control you. Don't do anything stupid, in other words. When you get angry, don't lose control. And it says also, don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. In other words, stay angry till tomorrow. let it go today. I mean, we all know what happens if you let anger fester into resentment, right? That leads to all kinds of emotional and spiritual problems if we let it fester and it becomes resentment. Even the big book calls resentment the number one offender, right? Okay. More people in recovery relapse because of resentments than any other single cause. So it is definitely something that we need to avoid. And I want you to understand, remember, anger is just a simple human reaction to situations we don't like. There's neither good nor bad in anger. It's what we do with the anger that matters. Don't lose control and do anything foolish, and don't let it fester and keep you going and going until it becomes a resentment. Do that and you'll be okay. Now, the obvious next question is, how in the world do we do that? How do we get over being angry when anger is just a natural human reaction? How do we keep it from getting out of hand? Well, the answer, my friends, is in working the 12 steps. If you've done the fourth step and done it correctly and thoroughly, you have at least started the process of understanding and forgiving those who have done you wrong in the past. Now, if you have not, then I urge you to do that as soon as you can, because that's the starting point for the real relief in this program. That's where real spiritual growth starts. Now, truthfully, for some of us, this is a long, drawn-out process. At least it was for me. And it was hard for me to forgive everyone on my resentment list, because frankly, some of the behavior towards me had been very bad, and I was very resentful and everything else, until one day my sponsor told me the secret, that I should pray for the person on my resentment list for everything good to happen to him. Now, indirectly, this was Jesus' command to love even our enemies. Okay, what does it mean to love someone? It means you want the best for them, and you are willing to give of yourself to see that that happens, right? So I prayed for this guy that got everything good that I wanted for myself, he'd have. If I wanted a good job, he'd have a good job. If I wanted a, you know, good house, he'd have a good house. Good car, he'd have a good car. I prayed for him every good thing I wanted for myself. And you know something? It's hard to stay angry with somebody you pray for every day. It really is. The other thing we need to do is practice the 10th step daily. Daily, we're supposed to review our day and see where we could have done better. When we find things we shouldn't have done, or things that we should have done but we left undone, then we need to ask God for forgiveness and for the strength to do better the next time. And, I might add, we need to make amends wherever those are necessary. When we do this daily, we have a much better perspective on what others are doing to us. What I have learned through the process is, contrary to what I thought before, the world was not out to get me. That I was completely wrong in believing that concept. Yeah, people had done things they shouldn't have done. People had left undone things they should have done. And sometimes that affected me. But rarely did I find in my past someone who was out to get me. It wasn't personal. The truth was, there's a lot of spiritually sick people out there, and they're just going along their lives, living their selfish, self-centered lives, and sometimes that affects other people. Like me. When I'm able to look at those people as though they are sick people instead of evil people, it's a lot easier to get over my anger with them. Think about the person that you love to hate, okay? Think about that person not as being evil and doing things to you that are evil, but think of them as spiritually sick people that are simply living their selfish, self-centered lives, and sometimes they cross your path and their actions affect you. You see the difference? It's hard to stay angry with a sick person. It's real easy to stay angry at an evil person. Now, when I'm able to do that, does their life improve? No. But mine does. You get the point? When I'm able to look at them as sick, then my life improves. There's a whole lot less stress and less emotional upheaval that I'm having to go through. And it doesn't affect them at all. Okay. Back to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Let's see what he said next in verse 23. So if you are presenting a sacrifice at the altar in the temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar, go and be reconciled to that person, then come and offer your sacrifice to God. Now remember the animal sacrifices of that day? That was for forgiveness, right? One of the primary types of sacrifice was a sin offering, where they tried to get forgiveness for their sins. And Jesus is saying, if somebody is angry at you, this is not where you're angry at somebody else, it's that they're angry with you. You realize someone is angry with you, and look how seriously Jesus takes it. He says, don't bring your sacrifice to the temple. I don't want it. Go and get reconciled with that person, then come back and do your sacrifice. You know how serious that statement was to the people of that day? Remember, they didn't have Jesus to justify their lives, right? They didn't get forgiveness through his sacrifice. They had to sacrifice animals for the forgiveness of their own sins. So, and their belief was if they couldn't go to the temple and offer these sacrifices, then they wouldn't be forgiven by God. Jesus is telling them, don't even bother trying to get forgiven for your sins. Go first and get reconciled with the one who's angry with you. And God doesn't want to forgive you until you forgive them. That's kind of scary. If you ever doubted the necessity of the 10th step in making amends, this should convince you otherwise. Jesus is emphatic about the need to seek reconciliation with others. Now, there are a few things I want to make sure you don't misunderstand here. First off, Jesus is talking about someone else having something against you. Now, the assumption here, and it's implied, that the person is upset with you because of a real offense you have caused, that it's legitimate. You've actually have to have done something that offended them. If they are upset with you over some imagined slight that never happened, then you're not responsible for that. You are responsible if they're upset with you over something you have actually done. And I want to tell you, be real careful when you're trying to make that assumption that this isn't real. Odds are we're just trying to justify it in our own minds. And we are all, as obsessive compulsive people, we are all world class at making assumptions like this. We can justify ourselves at the drop of a hat. So be real careful. And also, you can never let yourself off the hook by saying, yeah, I did that to them, but look what they did to me first. That's never a valid argument, ever. I mean, it doesn't matter what they did to us. It's what we did to them that we have to make amends for. We clean up our side of the street and let them worry about their side of the street. Now, okay, remember that spiritual axiom on the 10th step? Whenever we are upset, no matter what the cause, there's something the matter with us. Okay? No matter what they did to us, if we get all worked up over it and do something foolish, the blame is ours. What they did to us might have been bad, but what we do in retaliation is even worse. I guess a simple way to say this is God expects us to be grown-ups. He expects us to hold our tempers in all circumstances. If you can't hold your temper, walk away. Leave it be. Don't let anger force you to do something stupid. And the second thing I want to say about this situation is it is not necessary for the other party to accept your amends to make them valid. I mean, it's nice if they do, but our amends is our responsibility, and they are valid no matter how the other person reacts to it. Again, I'm going to clean up my side of the street and let them worry about their side. Now, before I close for the night, I want to show you two examples that Jesus talks about on the subject of hedging. The first one is from verse 27. You have heard the commandment that says you must not commit adultery. But I say anyone who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So if your eye, even your good eye, causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your hand, even your stronger hand, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, frankly, that is some pretty strong language. And frankly, it's a verse I don't want to take too literally. I'm not going to literally gouge out my eye. But this is what Jesus said, so we need to look at it. Again, what he's saying is, this is an example of Jesus hedging. The sin to be avoided is adultery. Now, Jesus says, don't even look at someone lustfully, because that could lead you to do wrong. And, I mean, do you understand the hedge here? If you never look at someone with lust, how can you ever commit adultery, right? Makes sense. Can anyone think of another hedge to put around that very sin of temptation? Something that wasn't even available in Jesus' day? How about TV shows and movies that show nudity or semi-nudity? A person prone to sexual addiction should absolutely avoid these at all costs. This would be an additional hedge around the more serious sexual sins. Okay, one last example, verse 33. You have also heard that our ancestors were told, you must not break your vows. You must carry out the vows you make to the Lord. But I say, don't make any vows. Do not say by heaven, because heaven is God's throne. And do not say by the earth, because the earth is his footstool. And do not say by Jerusalem, for Jerusalem is the city of the great king. Do not even say by my head, for you can't turn one hair white or black. Just say a simple yes, I will, or no, I won't. Anything beyond this is from the evil one. Okay, here's another example of hedging, right? Jesus says the sin to be avoided is breaking a vow. Now, I want to point out that vows were taken very seriously in Jesus' day. If you made a vow to do something and didn't do it, you lost honor in a big way. I mean, today, people say, do that again and I swear I will. And they don't really mean it. And, you know, the kid does it anyway and they don't do what they said they were going to do. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about serious stuff to these people. So the hedge Jesus says to put around breaking a vow is don't make any vows. If you don't make any vows, then you can't break them. Now, it's really important for us to relate, not necessarily to the specifics of each of these examples, but to the principles behind the specifics. if we want to avoid something that we know is wrong, simply don't put ourselves in a position to be tempted to do it. Right? That's what the whole lesson is about. Avoid putting ourselves in a position where it's even possible for us to do the sin. Okay, so what's the bottom line of today? Well, think for a moment. What is your personal weakness? What kind of a sin are you tempted by more than any other? Something that you know is wrong, but you love to be tempted by it. You need to identify that thing that tempts you and then figure out a way to build a hedge around it to avoid being tempted by that weakness. If it's possible, build more than one hedge, as Jesus gave examples of building a hedge around anger. He built three hedges before he got to the sin to be avoided. Now, if you do this, you're going to find that your life is a lot simpler and a whole lot more serene. Pray with me, please. Lord, we thank you for the word. We thank you for your teaching. We thank you that we have the opportunity to learn from you how to live life on life's terms. How you help us to live serene and happy and able to cope with the ups and downs of ordinary life. Help us, Lord, to grow spiritually and become a little bit more like you each day. Thank you, Jesus. Amen.